Final case for argument is 21-1708, Hyatt v. PTO. We're ready, Mr. Grossman, whenever you are.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Andrew Grossman for the appellant, and I would reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The uncontroverted evidence before the District Court showed the PTO adopted a secret rule to block Gilbert Hyatt from obtaining additional patents and enforced that rule for over a decade. The evidence further showed that the PTO maintains that rule in the current era of the Hyatt unit. Just after the Hyatt unit's leader took office in 2013, he told a former PTO official that the plan was to reject every single one of Hyatt's applications. The PTO proceeded to kill two of Hyatt's applications by running out all patent term on them in 2016, and the Hyatt unit's leader also instructed his examiners in 2016 to reject every application on multiple grounds, to run up the rejection count because it tells a story, to ignore relevant materials submitted by Hyatt when making rejections, to penalize Hyatt for things like typographical errors, and to withhold information from Hyatt that would allow him to avoid forced abandonment of his applications. And that is just a sampling of the evidence. The showing of bad faith was light years beyond what the Supreme Court held in Department of Commerce versus New York to justify substantial discovery on the government.
The district court here found the lack of evidence that the PTO presently has a no patents for Hyatt policy. What was the evidence with respect to the fact that I assume your argument was that it presently has that policy.
Yes, Your Honor.
That there is uncontroverted evidence that it presently has that policy?
There's uncontroverted evidence, Your Honor, that it did adopt that rule in 1997 and then continued to enforce it for 10 years.
My question is, how does that jive with the issue before the district court, which was whether the PTO presently has that policy?
Your Honor, when an agency adopts a rule, if the agency is going to depart from that rule, it has to acknowledge the change in policy that it's making. When we presented uncontroverted evidence that the PTO had, in fact, adopted and carried out this rule, the PTO had a burden to show that it had switched policies or to controvert that evidence and show that it did not, in fact, adopt that rule. We also introduced evidence, as I described, and evidence in addition to that, that supports that the PTO continues to carry out that rule. There is, for example, the packet of instructions that I mentioned from the leader of the Hyatt unit to Hyatt unit examiners that demonstrates that the agency continues to apply an incredibly prejudicial regime against Mr. Hyatt in ways that conflict with the agency's...
Those instructions are part of the administrative record?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so are you arguing that the district court judge's determination that no such rule existed now is not supported by the administrative record?
Your Honor, we are arguing three things. The first is that the court erred in constructing the administrative record by failing to follow the whole record rule. The second, that the court wrongly, essentially blocked all discovery, having found a strong showing of agency bad faith or misconduct. And third, that even given the record, the court erred procedurally as well as in substance in determining that there was no dispute in granting sua sponte summary judgment.
I'm not sure how the narrative you were giving us links up to those issues. I don't really care which of those you address first, but can you just address those issues?
Yes, Your Honor. So I'll start with the record issue. The district court gerrymandered the administrative record, and in doing so, it violated the fundamental rule that a challenged agency action has to be...
This is an abuse of discretion review, right?
I think that ultimately it's abuse of discretion. I think in this instance it goes down to de novo because the court, in two respects. One, the court paid lip service to the whole record rule and then in the very next breath excluded things from the record regarding the precise rule that is the subject of Mr. Hyatt's challenge here. That simply was a disregard of the whole record rule and that was legal error by the district court. Likewise,
why is it legal error? I thought his rationale was what I'm reviewing is whether this rule exists now. I'm going to exclude documents or possible testimony that pertain to timeframes not relevant to this current rule or this current alleged rule. Why is that an abuse of discretion?
When an agency action is challenged, Your Honor, that review has to be conducted upon the whole record. And so it's important what action was being challenged here. We alleged and presented evidence that this rule was adopted in 1997 and was carried forward in various forms to the present. That made the whole record a record that began in 1997 or perhaps even before then. And so the court's gerrymandering of the record to rule out all of that evidence before even considering it was
gerrymandering? What does that mean? How does that applicable to what you're talking about here?
It's the court's exclusion of that evidence from the administrative record.
What was the point of him deciding whether that rule existed way back in 2013? If what your relief is asking for now, let's just assume I disagree with you about the Bowen issue because it'll clean up this conversation. If we get rid of the rest of that complaint, you can reach that if you want to, but. If what you're trying to do is say, have the district court order Hyatt to revoke its no patents for Hyatt rule, if their defense is, we do not currently have such a rule, then why is anything that happened in 2013 or before relevant to what's happening now?
Well, Your Honor, when an agency adopts and applies an unlawful rule, the law recognizes that that rule may have impacts that as part of the standard vacatur and remand process, the agency must effect a complete rescission of the rule as well as of its effects. Now, that's something that would potentially give Hyatt a variety of relief regarding the agency's exercise of discretion, both with respect particularly with respect to applications that are still before the agency. In other words, ones that have not yet proceeded to judicial review in court.
I don't understand that. If there is no rule in place for them to revoke, what makes the difference if there was one in 2013 with regards to currently ongoing patent applications?
Well, Your Honor, I think the court can't simply assume that there is not a rule in place. That is what the PTO has contended.
But that's what the district court was trying to decide. Is there a rule in place now?
And he decided that.
He decided that issue.
The court decided that issue by excluding evidence. Now, even if you disagree with me on the record issue, in other words, drawing the temporal limit, the court excluded from the administrative record numerous materials concerning the current era of the Hyatt unit. And I would start with the declaration of Jessica Harrison, in which she testified, sworn under oath, that the current leader of the Hyatt unit described in 2013 that he planned to reject every single one of Mr. Hyatt's applications. This was after he had been on the job for a period of a couple months. Pardon?
That's in 2013.
That is in 2013. And but I think what makes that important is that's where the court drew the line. And so the court held that the current era was the Hyatt unit era, and it disregarded evidence that it said was stale because it related to 2012 and earlier. So even if you go with the court on that line, we think it's wrong, but even if you go with the court on that, the court's evidentiary decisions in constructing the record still didn't make sense. Ms. Harrison also testified that in 2018, Mr. Morse described...
What's the basis for the exclusion of that declaration?
He said basis?
Yeah.
The court said that Ms. Harrison, like some of the other witnesses, had left the PTO by 2012. And that's true, but her evidence that she testified to postdates that date. And so that was not considered.
Wait, so again, abuse of discretion, right? Why is it an abuse of discretion for him to decline to consider a declaration from somebody that left the PTO in 2012 when the relevant question is a current time frame? I don't know how far back you want to go to define a current time frame, but it can't be 2012.
Your Honor, I'm sticking with what the court drew for the purpose of this argument. So 2012 and earlier is out under that line. The reason
she left before then.
She left before then, but
possibly be an abuse of discretion to exclude somebody who wasn't presently employed?
Your Honor, I would ask, I think it goes, and if you could let me describe, the contents of the declaration attest to PTO conduct, planning, and activities in the current Hyatt unit era. She was friends with the leader of the Hyatt unit. She met the Hyatt unit's leader for lunch after she had left the PTO. In 2013, when he had just taken over the job, and he was describing to her his plans for the Hyatt unit.
I don't understand how that's an abuse of discretion to throw out knowledge she gained through lunches and a friendship when she's not officially employed by the PTO.
Because it speaks to decisions that the PTO made that are absent from the record because the PTO has excluded them from the record. That's the whole purpose of going beyond the record when there's a strong showing.
Okay, let's assume that I don't think that's an abuse of discretion. What else do you have? He did allow you a evidentiary hearing because of the bad faith nature of these allegations. He did allow you to supplement the record.
Your Honor.
You just want more than he allowed.
Your Honor, we were allowed almost nothing. I would encourage the court to simply look at the transcript of the afternoon long depositions that were conducted. We were not able to carry out practically any line of questioning, and all the court drew from it was simply that the PTO's the current head of the Hyatt unit and two other officials deny that they're familiar with any rule to deny patents to Hyatt. We had different areas of circumstantial evidence that we wanted to go over with the witnesses. We were unable to do that. We had no documentary discovery, which is what you would expect.
This is record review. You get the record.
There was, Your Honor, there was no record in this case. The agency did not, in and of itself, assemble a record for a no patents for Hyatt rule. The agency denied
how
that it currently...
How can they assemble a record if there is no record for this rule? That's their position. Are you claiming that they have withheld documents or they have hidden documents? Did you make a non-frivolous allegation that the district court could have ruled on to that effect?
Your Honor, I would encourage you to look at the New York versus Department of Commerce decision by the district court because I think it lays out how this works, and the Supreme Court generally affirmed the approach the court there took. When a party makes a strong showing of agency bad faith, the court can no longer rely on the agency's representations regarding the record. The record is no longer trustworthy. Because there is that bad showing, and there is a presumption that if the agency is engaged in bad faith, it is not putting evidence of that into the record. Here, the agency in and of itself produced no record. It denied that it had this rule, even though it didn't controvert the evidence dating back to 1997.
Right, so, and in those circumstances, you supplement the record, right?
Well, except the court, first of all, refused to supplement the record with the very evidence that it held created the strong showing of bad faith, that is these witnesses' declarations.
Let me just back up on this. Even if he allowed that evidence in, why is it relevant to whether there is a current rule in place?
Your Honor, two reasons. First of all, when an agency adopts a rule, that as a legal matter, that rule remains in force going forward. That's how the
FDA... That's a revocation argument.
That's a formalistic argument, right. But that's what the law is, FCC versus Fox, as well as Regents versus University of California.
But this is where I don't understand what that gets you.
And second, Your Honor...
If they improperly revoke the no patents for Hyatt rule, what do you care if it was properly... or improperly revoked, as long as it was revoked. That's what you're asking the district court for.
Your Honor, if the agency came into court and provided a fulsome record demonstrating that it had revoked the rule, this would be a very different case, and we wouldn't be making this sort of argument. And this would be, as I said, an entirely different appeal. That is not what happened because the district court did not require the PTO to do that. Instead, the district court relied upon PTO's officials denying that they have such a rule and rested its hand on that, notwithstanding that it had found that Hyatt made the required strong showing of bad faith that warrants discovery. If there is going to be discovery in an APA case based on that sort of strong showing, the discovery has to complete the record. That's the language that's used in the Supreme Court decisions. And in this instance, there was no attempt made to complete the record. We asked for discovery.
I'm a little baffled you say there's no attempt. You disagree with the district court's way of doing it, but he allowed you a live evidentiary hearing where he himself could hear the credibility of the witnesses. Now, if you want to discuss the scope of that, that's one thing. But to say that the record wasn't supplemented is just wrong. It was supplemented with these testimonies. You were given what? Either five depositions or three with a rule, whatever.
Ultimately, Your Honor, we were limited to three. The PTO's 30B6 witness was unprepared, and so that was not a fruitless fruitful deposition at all. And the two that we were able to undertake, one was for a narrow purpose, and the leader of the Hyatt unit, as Your Honor, I'm sure, saw from the deposition transcript, that deposition was effectively limited to the district court asking four separate times whether or not he was aware of a no patents for Hyatt rule. That was what happened at the culmination of every single line of questioning that we undertook, except for those lines of questioning where we were simply blocked. And we were blocked, by the way, on questioning regarding current Hyatt unit activities, where despite being designated in part as a 30B6 organizational witness, the Hyatt unit's leader just professed that he had no personal knowledge, and therefore the district court forced us onto a different topic. This was effectively good for nothing. It was futile in terms of being adequate to demonstrate the existence or non-existence of a current no patents for Hyatt rule. I noted also that the district court excluded from the administrative record other Hyatt unit era internal communications. The district court did this in a single sentence, stating that they were all subject to the deliberative process privilege. The PTO never claimed that any of these materials were deliberative at all or privileged. It produced them to Mr. Hyatt in previous litigation without making any privilege claim. And on the substance, none of them were privileged.
So let me just get back to it. You're saying that the evidentiary hearing he held to supplement the record was insufficient for him to address the agency's decision-making that you're challenging?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and that's and whether he has compiled a sufficient record to review the agency's decision-making is an abuse of discretion standard for us.
It is an abuse of discretion to the extent that the court views it as incorporating the district court's view that this is all subject to a mandamus standard, which appears to be the basis for the court's line drawing in terms of the evidence, that again would be subject to de novo because that's obviously legal error.
I think we're close. You're well into your rebuttal. Want to save it?
Yes, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Peter Sollard on behalf of the USPTO and the Director, appearing in my capacity as a Special Assistant United States Attorney. Mr. Hyatt has raised essentially four different issues before this Court in the briefing. I'd like to start with the way that the record was constructed. As the Court has already noted, that is subject to review for an abuse of discretion. This is a highly unusual case.
Let me just ask you this. Why didn't the district court just let in all these declarations from these former employees about, to the extent they were testifying about their time at the agency?
Right. Your Honor, I think that the problem is this is an unusual case. And as Your Honor is well aware, having dealt with prior litigations involving the same appellant, The patent applications at issue are rather complex and sprawling and date back very far in time. And I think that the district...
I will answer very quickly.
I think the district court wanted to draw a reasonable line for managing this case without reaching back to the entire history and saying, look, as Your Honor said, and as USPTO said in their briefing on this issue, this is about prospective relief. Do we have this rule in place now that should be set aside because it's illegal? And so you can only reach so far back in time and claim it's relevant to what's going on now.
I guess my practical interest in this was if he just let this in and said, well, whatever may have happened in the past, the record as it stands now with the testimony of these still leads me to the conclusion that there's no rule in place. This other evidence isn't relevant. We'd still be reviewing that current decision for substantial evidence on the administrative record, and we wouldn't be quarreling about whether these declarations should be in and out. I guess you would just argue that none of that's an abuse of discretion.
It's not an abuse of discretion to say that that's too far removed in time to be probative of the question before the court. And I think that Your Honor's right that the result would be the same, but also it would have involved additional complexities in creating the record because they are declarations, not depositions that were subject to cross-examination. And so it would open up numerous additional substantive issues that the court was not forced to address because they just simply determined it was too far removed to be relevant even if taken as true as of the time that they were made. And so
the suggestion that there was the so-called policy, it does influence how you view that. If the PTO had never had any policy and had no witnesses to say this is what we did, it would be a different case than the case of having a so-called prior policy. So it has some relevance to this analysis, right?
It could, Your Honor, if Mr. Hyatt had tied that past activity through a more constant stream through time, like if it was tied to current happenings in the case. But four of the declarations are from the early 2000s, and only two of them go up to even 2012. So most of them are even farther removed. And then there's a big jump, right? There's this gap, and you get to the present time, and we see all that's happening in the cases that is part of the administrative record, the sampling of documents that the USPTO put in involving the prosecution of Mr. Hyatt's applications that the district court reviewed, that the district court found that to be the most probative evidence because it's objective. It is circumstantial, but he reviewed it with care, not to the level it would be subject to review for its actual legal correctness in a 141 or 145 proceeding. But he reviewed it and found that the USPTO was applying legitimate rejections, that it was grappling with the issues, that it was providing reasoned bases, and that these documents were long and substantive. There are, 50, 7,500 page documents each time.
Justice, if the court had permitted Mr. Hyatt to supplement the record to the extent that they wanted to, the best wish that they had to supplement the record. How much material are we talking about?
Well, part of the problem, Your Honor, is, as we pointed out in the red brief, is we have no idea.
I thought the district court said, didn't he refer to 1.7 million pages? I don't know what that was to.
Yes, so in a related litigation with Mr. Hyatt, the Section 145 actions from the District of D.C.
I'm sorry to interrupt your answer.
I can give a very quick round off to the answer. There was extensive discovery there relative to the Latches rejection. And much of that discovery that Mr. Hyatt obtained in that proceeding was the basis for filing this complaint. And so filing all of his file histories happened in that litigation, and it was, it was millions of pages. So, that was as of 2017, I believe. And so there would be all the intervening events. I think that the key issue is that the district court was entitled to rely on the live testimony where he looked at Mr. Morse in the eye, and he himself on five separate times during the evidentiary hearing looked him in the eye and asked him, is there such a policy? And Mr. Morse said no. And he's entitled to credit that. He asked the question. He looked at him in the eye and made that. And that in conjunction with the objective evidence, we put in the USPTO filed two sets of listings of all of the actions being taken in Mr. Hyatt's applications, one over a six-week period, one over a roughly six-month period. So there's that whole listing of all those actions. And then because they're so massive, we only filed the actual copies of a subset of that. The district court looked at all that and found it's not a smokescreen. The USPTO is just not making things up to reject Mr. Hyatt's claims. The USPTO is doing what it said it is doing. It is trying to bring his patent applications through the examination process and provide final decisions on the merits, including final decisions by the examiner. And now there are many cases percolating through the board, and there are now multiple Section 145 actions pending in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. Mr. Hyatt's counsel is focused primarily on the evidentiary record. Now, so I don't want to go too much beyond that, but I do want to talk about this supposed lack of notice. I think that in our brief, the USPTO has walked through very carefully the procedure that Judge Ellis followed here. It was reasoned. There were orders at each step telling what was going to happen next. We're going to decide what evidence you get. what discovery can be taken. Now we're going to decide, I have this remaining count that hasn't been dismissed. Now we're going to decide, because this is an APA case, what the record is for decision. And you get to put in briefing on that. And we're going to include the hearing that we had, and you get to tell me what else should go in there. And then he ruled on that. He said, now that we have the record that I told you was to decide this case, now we're going to have a hearing on the merits, so I can decide this thing, whether there's evidence or not. And both parties had ample opportunity to argue orally before the court and point to all the evidence in the record in support of their case. And then what Judge Ellis did was take all of that under consideration and write a decision on the record. Not summary judgment, but a decision on the record, where he's allowed to weigh credibility determinations. For example, the testimony of Mr. Morse, where he himself asked these questions, and that confirm what the objective evidence shows. The amount of work, the serious work, that the USPTO is doing to grapple with Mr. Hyatt's applications.
Anything further?
If your honors have nothing further, I have no other.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll restore 2 minutes of rebuttal, Mr. Grossman, if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Several quick points. First, Mr. Hyatt came to court with evidence that the PTO carried out for over a decade what is a blatantly unlawful activity and kept it secret. I mean, this is the kind of evidence that a district court will probably never see in an entire lifetime of service on the bench, and it warranted more than Mr. Hyatt received here in terms of looking into the seriousness of his claims and the PTO's current activities. With respect to the supplementation of the record, we did request that the entire file histories be added. We also proposed as an alternative a limited subset of very specific evidence that we identified in a table that is in the appendix at page 1484 to 1513 that identifies specific documents, many of which touch upon the Hyatt unit, in other words, the same era that the court was focused on and limited the record to, and yet nonetheless excluded all of this evidence without any explanation whatsoever.
So did the district court actually rule on each one of your objections to the diminution of the record?
Your Honor, the court asked for pleadings to propose material. We did that, and the court rejected what we had proposed.
It just sounded to me, and you tell me if I was wrong, but sounded to me you got a fair shot. You were allowed to argue and point to the court, these are the documents that we want, this is why we think they're probative, and the court ruled. Is that?
Your Honor, the court did not examine any of the documents, at least not in any way that's reflected on the record.
That's not what I asked, counsel. I asked, you got a chance to argue which documents you thought should be in, and you got a chance to base your legal grounds, and the court heard that and made a ruling.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. For example, the court excluded wholesale, possibly all of these documents, based on the deliberative process privilege, and that's not something we were ever able to argue on a document-by-document basis where we had the opportunity to demonstrate that, no, actually none of these were privileged at all. So I'm afraid I could not agree with that.
Okay.
In terms of notice, my friend said that there was notice. I will simply note that the PTO's brief does not identify a single case whatsoever where a court found clear notice in circumstances like this. What the district court never did was say, I'm going to enter judgment, I'm going to enter summary judgment, or anything like that. If the court had done that, we would have pointed out the correct legal standard. We would have filed a rule.
What do you think a hearing on the merits means?
The court had said again and again and again that it was going to consider our request for further discovery. There would be opportunity to argue on that. We assumed in the context that what the court intended was to have a hearing regarding how the case was going to proceed. I think if you look at the prior hearings that were in this case, the district court was a little bit, I would say, erratic in that the hearings tended to cover a wide variety of topics, more or less whatever was on the court's mind that morning. And we expected just about the same in that particular hearing. We were surprised when the court entered sua sponte summary judgment, particularly because even at that last hearing on the merits, the court said nothing about
any judgment on the administrative record.
The court said it was a sua sponte summary judgment, Your Honor.
It says summary judgment on the administrative record.
It was a sua sponte judgment, Your Honor. In any instance, the court provided no indication that it was doing that, even at the hearing. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that the judgment be reversed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding for this morning.
All right.